From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The Department of Health and Human Services lost track of about 1,500 unaccompanied minors. Today, the story of the human trafficking ring that led the government to change its policies about keeping track of migrant children.
And so if they complained, if they said, wait a second, we don't have enough money to buy food, we can't call our families, they started receiving, these threats.
And a conversation with writer and storyteller Luis Alberto Urrea.
Somebody walks up to you in the middle of a perfectly fine morning and says, you're going to get put out of the country soon. You just live your life. You don't go around thinking, well, I'm an oppressed Mexican.
Plus, new music from Uruguayan songwriter Jorge Drexler. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and in the studio with me is producer Fernanda Chavarri.
Maria, I think we should start this story in 2014, in the summer of 2014, to be exact.
It is a huge humanitarian crisis on the border right now.
Stopping the surge of unaccompanied minors arriving.
The number of unaccompanied minors who were showing up at the border in Texas skyrockets. Texas border officials, local officials, they don't know what to do. They don't know where to put these kids. The facilities that they have can only hold so many people. And photos become public from a Border Patrol agent's phone of terrible conditions, of crowded rooms with little kids on the floor, like basically just huddled with one another. And then some of them start being transferred to Arizona.
From the Arizona Public Media Newsroom, I'm Amanda LeClaire. For the first time since the story broke, Border Patrol officials let members of the media into the Nogales facility where about 1,000 children from Central America are being detained. AZPM's Fernanda Chavarri was at the facility, and she joins us now. Good morning, Fernanda.
Good morning, Amanda.
So let's start at the outside of the facility.
At the time, I was a reporter for Arizona Public Media. Well, I first want to let everybody know that this tour was a restricted tour. We did not get to see the whole facility. We were escorted. We all wanted to know more information. Can we see where these kids are being held? And finally, they allowed us to tour one of the facilities where they held these unaccompanied minors. We weren't allowed to take photos or record or anything. There was only one assigned photographer who could do that. And then they told us that we couldn't ask questions of anyone around or talk to the kids. And then when you walk into this room, it was just this giant facility, really high ceilings, open space. And it was sort of divided in tiny little cells, like a jail cell, with chain-linked fences and barbed wire in the top. As the tour person was telling us something about whether, like, the number of kids or the process, I just completely tuned that person out because there was this little kid to my left. He could not have been more than, like, 9 or 10 years old, with his hands up against his forehead, and he had his head leaning up against the chain-linked fence, and he was just sobbing. He was sobbing. And I couldn't, like, I didn't want to get kicked out, so clearly I couldn't approach him because they told us not to talk to them. But I turned to him, and then when he, like, moved his hands, I just smiled at him. And the look in his eyes, it was just this sort of blank stare, even though he was crying. And that was the thing that I think I remember the most.
When they left there eventually, where would they go?
So at that point, they were supposed to be there for no more than 3 or 4 days. Some of them stay there a little bit longer. And then Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security hands the kids over to Health and Human Services. They're under their watch now. And then from there, they would be placed with their parent, their uncle, their family member that was supposed to sort of come in and claim them. And then they would be put in the hands of a trusted sponsor, what they call, like a guardian. we start to hear towards the end of, 2014 stories of where kids have ended up, what cities, what schools, what's happening to them. But in Bloomington, Ohio, one boy was held against his will working in an egg farm. And he was one of those unaccompanied minors that came from Central America in 2014.
Today, we're going to begin our show with some context in regards to the stories you've been hearing about unaccompanied child migrants. Those are children who make the often dangerous trek to the United States all alone.
So recently, the big story is that the government lost track of around 1,500 young immigrants that went through its custody.
Okay, listen to this story. The U.S. government has lost track of nearly 1,500 migrant children. All of them were placed in...
And there was this huge social media response to this story. A lot of people were really outraged, and some of them were tweeting with this hashtag, "Where are the children?" There was also a lot of confusion, and people were conflating two very different news stories that involved child migrants. One of the stories was about how Health and Human Services lost track of about 1,500 unaccompanied children who arrived in the United States in recent years. There's another story, which is about a new Trump administration policy, which is separating parents and children who are arriving at the border together. Now, these are two separate things, but a lot of people on social media were kind of conflating these two. So for today, though, we're going to focus just on that first story, the story of the 1,500 so-called missing children.
These are the kids, like the ones that we were just talking about, who arrived at the U.S. border as unaccompanied minors, and then they were released into the custody of a guardian, also known as a sponsor. So to understand how the government lost track of these 1,500 children, we first have to understand why the government is keeping track of these kids to begin with. And to understand that, we need to look at what happened at an egg farm back in 2014 in Ohio.
So who was the boy who was forced to work on the egg farm?
His name was withheld because of his situation, the vulnerability, and the fact that he was a minor at the time. And we know his story because it was featured in a documentary called Trafficked in America. And the person behind that documentary is
Daffodil Aldan. I'm a producer at the UC Berkeley Investigative Reporting Program.
So this boy is 14 years old and is from Guatemala.
Over the Cuchumatanes mountain range, and it's extremely remote.
He's one of many children, and he's the only boy. His family is living in extreme poverty. There were times where he would go days without eating because they couldn't afford food. They couldn't even afford fertilizer for their coffee plantation, which is how they made a living. So someone down the street, a family member, friend, neighbor, says, "Hey, I can get young men, young boys, teenagers to the U.S.
Telling people in the village that he could get them some schooling, get them jobs for $15,000.
So the family can afford to pay for this smuggling service.
The way that a lot of this works, it's actually pretty common, but with the recruiter, what he was doing with a lot of the people who traveled was he would have them give over the deed to whatever small bit of property they had, whether it was a house or a piece of land, as collateral. So these families would give over the deeds to their houses. And then what you would travel with as a young teenager is with a debt on your head. So you are traveling knowing that as soon as you get to the U.S., you will begin to work off a debt of $15,000. Otherwise, your family does not get their land back.
So he goes with this smuggler.
They walked, they rode buses, and then they also rode the beast train. So they get to the border.
So Border Patrol takes him in the same way that we just mentioned about the kids that were put in these sort of temporary facilities.
They're instructed to give the name of this person who's supposed to pick them up and get them to Ohio. After that, that person is called, and it turns out that this person has already been receiving other boys.
They didn't even notice that this person had multiple people listing him as their sponsor? That didn't even raise a flag anywhere?
if they noticed, they didn't do anything about it, but I don't think they noticed at the time because they said that they were just, you know, overwhelmed, that they weren't, you know, they were just trying to move these kids as quickly as possible. And the sponsor, in this case, it was one of the traffickers, picked up the boy and drove him to the trailer park. And he's shown inside this trailer that's falling apart, that already has multiple people living in it, that is foul, that doesn't have running water. And he's told, this is where you're going to live, and you're going to work at this massive egg production facility beginning tomorrow.
He didn't know where he was. He didn't speak English. And he didn't have contact with his family.
Then what happens is you're making, you know, you have to pay off that debt. You're making $500 or $600 a week. But the recruiter slash trafficker who's back in Guatemala has the associates working here deduct a majority of his paycheck to pay him back. The boys were ending up getting only $50 or $75 of that paycheck. And so if they complained, if they said, wait a second, we don't have enough money to buy food, we can't call our families, they started receiving, you know, these threats, both from the trafficker in Guatemala, who is right near their families, and from the associates here in the U.S. who were controlling their housing and their movements. This is how kind of the business of human labor trafficking works, is that companies will hire labor contractors to bring in their labor. And so what that does is it allows the company to separate itself legally from the liability of having to protect these workers. In this egg farm case, the contractor was actually in conversation with the recruiter slash trafficker in Guatemala. They talked about bringing teenagers to the farm to work.
Now, mind you, while all of this is going on, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, this 14-year-old boy is in the hands of this man in Ohio. They don't know more than that.
There was someone from ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is part of HHS. There was someone who went out and did a visit to this trailer park, and they went to one of the trailers and they knocked on the door and they weren't allowed in. And that was it. That's where that ended. There was no follow-up after that.
So how do these kids get uncovered? I mean, how is it that if Health and Human Services basically walked away when they were doing a home check, supposedly, how does it happen that this story actually breaks?
Well, I asked Daffodil about that.
When he traveled from Guatemala, one of the teenagers in his group was a 16-year-old who was from a nearby village and was very frustrated and uncomfortable and upset over the situation that he was living in. And he complained to the recruiter slash trafficker in Guatemala. And he said, I don't want to work here anymore. I want to leave. And that's when he received the threat that his father would be shot and killed if he tried to quit his job. And he had an actual relative in the U.S. living in Florida. He had an uncle, and he had actually called him, and then the uncle just hears his nephew saying, please help me. I don't know where I am exactly. I need help. And he was crying to him and sort of pleading for him to help him. And the uncle decides that despite being undocumented, he needs to get help for his nephew. So he called the local sheriff. Eventually, after a few months of surveillance, they decided that there were people who were being victimized, and they closed in on the trailer park and raided.
The 2015 case ended up with some of the people who were involved in trafficking these kids going to federal prison. And then the kids ended up getting special visas that are reserved for victims of human trafficking. All in all, 8 teenagers had been trafficked to work on this farm. This case was a sort of unique example of how the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services had handed over these minors to traffickers. So after that raid in Ohio, many people started to question, is the Department of Health and Human Services doing enough to take care of these kids?
Coming up on Latino USA, we look at what's changed in how the U.S. treats unaccompanied children from Central America. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children to help ensure a brighter future. More information is available at aecf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before the break, we heard about a labor trafficking case in which the victims were unaccompanied minors from Central America who had turned themselves in at the U.S. border in 2014. Now we want to look at the agency that is responsible for the care of these children and teens.
And that agency is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
That's Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri, who is back in the studio with me.
We've already said this in the show, but just to clarify, under HHS, there's an office called the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and they're the ones that take the young migrants from Border Patrol and essentially take custody of them at that point.
What we want to do now is to look at what happened after it was discovered that about a dozen of those teens were placed in the hands of labor traffickers.
And to do that, we're going to bring in Garence Burke. She's an investigative reporter with the Associated Press who has broken some of these stories, and she's covered the topic for years. She says there's been a shift in the way HHS screens potential sponsors or guardians who end up taking custody of the kids.
HHS has improved some of its child welfare policies, but really has failed to implement some crucial reforms needed to keep the children safe.
Let's start back before the spike of unaccompanied minors at the border.
Back in 2012, for instance, the government required that the adults be fingerprinted, go through background checks, submit original copies of their birth certificates, and even sign agreements stating that the children would actually appear in immigration court and sort of fill out this whole elaborate set of forms to prove that they actually were who they said they were.
Fast forward to 2014. Basically, every federal agency involved, HHS, DHS, everyone is just freaking out because there's way too many kids. They don't have a place to put them. So they start scaling back on those requirements for sponsors.
To move the unaccompanied children out of government shelters and into sponsors' homes more quickly. So what we found was that the government stopped fingerprinting most adults seeking to claim the children. Then HHS stopped requiring that sponsors submit original copies of their birth certificates. And then the next month, it decided that sponsors didn't even need to complete forms that laid out their personal and identifying information before they actually sent the children over to their homes.
And that's where a lot of these cases fell through the cracks.
Now, I identified more than two dozen children who were placed with sponsors who subjected them to sexual abuse, labor trafficking, or severe abuse and neglect.
So these kids were incredibly vulnerable. I mean, the places where they ended up were pretty bad.
And that included a Honduran teen who was forced to dance at cantinas, another Central American teen who was forced to cook and clean and care for a group of younger children in a Florida trailer park.
So when the story breaks about the egg farm, what happens locally? What happens in Ohio, for example?
So a Republican congressman from Ohio, Rob Portman, says,
how could the federal government take these kids in, try to protect them, and then as they send them out to families, you know, pending a court date, give them right back to the people who had brought them up here?
So you have this Republican congressman speaking on behalf of these children.
We've got these kids. They're here. They're living on our soil. And for us to just, you know, assume someone else is going to take care of them and throw them to the wolves, which is what HHS was doing, is flat out wrong. I don't care what you think about immigration policy. It's wrong.
These cases were made public in part because of Garen's reporting, and then federal officials start to bring back a more thorough background check for sponsors.
The agency also started doing what they described as safety and well-being calls, which is where a case manager contacts the home where the child is placed 30 days after they've been sent there.
However, at the same time, you have people being a little bit more afraid to come forward and say, hey, I'm so-and-so's mother. I'd like to be his guardian. I'd like to take him on to my home and be in charge of him if I'm undocumented.
So they're afraid to go and pick up their child because they themselves are undocumented, and then they're going to be in the system. So were they sending other people to go pick up their kids for them?
Oftentimes, yes. And that's part of why in this whole story of the, you know, where are the children, hashtag where are the children, and, you know, or HHS lost a bunch of kids. Part of that is the scenario that you just described. Somebody becomes the sponsor of this kid, the guardian, but really that kid is ending up with the kid's mom or a relative, but that person's undocumented. So when HHS tries to do a follow-up,
they don't answer the phone.
They don't answer the phone. Or they're not even with that sponsor anymore because that sponsor was just kind of like a
go-between.
Yeah, like a go-between so that they could end up with a family member who might be undocumented. Side note here, it's important to remember that these children and teens are not permanently in the U.S. They're here waiting for their day in front of an immigration judge so that they can petition to stay. Another thing that comes into play is a recent move by the Trump administration to criminalize anyone involved in any way with the smuggling of unaccompanied minors, and they call this the Search Initiative.
If you were at all involved with bringing these kids or paying for these kids, that now you could be criminally liable for that.
Yeah, exactly.
So obviously, this move sent a wave of fear through immigrant communities. ICE officials said that this surge initiative was aimed at dismantling human smuggling operations.
But advocates say that it expands to any parent who might have paid money to get their kid across the border. So let's talk about what happened in April of this year.
Going on to the issue that was raised earlier, you indicated, Mr. Wagner, and your testimony a moment ago.
In a Senate hearing, an HHS official mentioned the missing kids, and Ohio Senator Rob Portman, a Republican, responded.
That's not consistent with the data. We had learned, as we said earlier, that about 1,475 kids out of 7,000, roughly, that you called, you had no idea where they were. That's not 100%. That's about 19% totally unaccounted for.
And basically, there is, like, extraordinary hysteria, right? I mean, social media, hashtag where are the children,
this is
hashtag
where
are our children. I mean, interesting things happening on social media.
Yes, you have people on the left who are saying, how could you possibly lose these children? Which, by the way, also gives you this picture where, like, they literally put them somewhere and then they just got lost. When, like, really it's that they can't track their sponsors. So they're not sure. They're not answering the phone.
And then there's this other thing, which is that maybe some of these kids just don't want to be found, right? Their sponsors don't want to be found.
And then you have people on the right saying, why are you making a big deal out of this? It's not HHS's responsibility to make sure that they keep tabs on these kids. HHS put out an official statement, and I'll read you a quote from the person in charge. It's Stephen Wagner, the acting assistant secretary for the Administration for Children and Families. And it says, quote, the unaccompanied children program is being abused. It was never intended to be a foster care system with more than 10,000 children in custody at an immediate cost to the federal taxpayer of over $1 billion per year. End quote. So to sum it up, you have these two things happening that are in conflict with each other. There are policies that HHS put in place meant to prevent kids from ending up in the hands of traffickers. Policies that require a more thorough background check for people taking care of the kids. At the same time, by asking for more information about the sponsor or guardian, family members who are undocumented often don't feel safe coming forward to claim the kids. Especially in this climate, where all aspects of immigration enforcement are being ramped up. But I do want to make it clear that we are not saying these 1,500 kids, the ones that the government can't track, are necessarily in danger or lost. They may have moved, or maybe their families just don't want to be found. The point is that these are children, and they're vulnerable. So it's important for them to end up with a responsible adult. And the question that a lot of people are asking right now is, what is the government's role in making sure that happens? In the last 5 years, about 180,000 unaccompanied minors have gone through this process. most of them from Central America.
Thank you, Fernanda.
And I just want to give a special thanks to Daffodil Atlan and Andres Seidel, producers of Trafficked in America, a PBS Frontline documentary that is absolutely worth watching.
The U.S.-Mexico border has always been a place that makes people have to confront issues regarding their nationality, their identity, and their politics. But few understand this region like those who have grown up alongside it, people like writer Luis Alberto Urrea. Born in Tijuana and raised in San Diego, Luis has written over a dozen books, including memoirs, poetry, novels, and nonfiction. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his nonfiction book, The Devil's Highway, which tells the true story of a group of men who tried to cross one of the most dangerous stretches of the U.S.-Mexico border. I spoke to Luis recently in Chicago about his latest book, The House of Broken Angels. Although this book is fiction, it's based on an actual event, which is that Urrea's eldest brother was turning 74, and he was also dying of cancer. So his family decided to throw him one last blowout birthday party. Here's Luis reading a passage from the book. In his novel, his brother is referred to as Big Angel.
Dying was for worms and chickens, not angels. Bone cancer? He had found herbs and minerals that would make bones rebuild like coral reefs. Vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin A, chaga tea. Tumors in his organs? Turmeric, selenium, by golly. I am invincible, he told himself. I am not invisible. Even in his wheelchair, Big Angel believed he could kick the ass. Anything that came at him, and everybody else believed it too. They needed it to be true.
So, Luis, really, this book is based on a true story of your half-brother's birthday party?
So one of the nieces said, let's throw him, they call him Pops. Let's throw Pops a party. And everybody understood it was his last party on Earth, right? And my brother liked the idea because he, you know, it was like you could have a wake, but you could direct it. You could be there, you know, and receive.
So Mexican.
¿Verdad? You could like, get all the praise and have everybody tell you how special you are.
Kiss the ring.
Yeah, they did, too. They kissed his hand. And his mom was turning 100, and she died the week before his party. And, you know, era egoísta, mi hermano, so... I've been telling audiences, you know, because they all go, oh how sad.
Poor thing,
and
right.
I said, no, he was irritated. He's like, Ama, you know, it was my weekend. You stole my thunder. Because he was still the patriarch. Even in his wheelchair, he was the godfather. He arranged to have her funeral the day before his party.
Ay, Dios mío.
And it was such a classic insanity to have these two events put together. It was, to me, kind of an ultimate Latino Mexicano experience of funeral, party down.
But you know, Luis, I think that the thing about this book that I love is that you write with that kind of authentic and organically Mexicano-ness.
Yeah, it's pretty Mexicano. I mean, it's, you know, I heard my family resonating the whole time. Every voice, every grosería, every joke.
So you're talking, it's just a tiny little word, but I circled it. You were like, it must have come from their father who called them hotcakes in Spanish. What did he call them?
Los hoquequis.
Los hoquequis.
Los panqueques.
Vamos a comer unos panqueques.
Unos panqueques.
So you're basically, you know, because when you're a young person, or even like me as a Mexican woman who's already been in this country, oof, tanto. But I'll read that and I'll be like, oh my God, I love it. I love seeing something that is so very particularly Mexican again.
I love it too.
And so know, 100% American too.
It is. You know, I get the kids laughing a lot because I always tell them, you know, I didn't do sliced bread till fifth grade, man. I grew up on corn tortillas, man. So we would eat peanut butter on a hot corn tortilla. And I always tell them, la pina butter. And they all start dying. I say, yeah, la pina butter. And you rode una baica too, didn't you? And you had birthday keki, except your abuelita said un quequisito, que no? They're, you know, because those things come rushing back. And I say, you know, if you grew up eating peanut butter on a hot tortilla, then you thought everybody ate it the same way. It would melt and run down your wrist and you'd bite it and lick it, bite it and lick it. Those are details that are just human.
You know what I put on the tortilla?
Uh-oh.
Philadelphia cream cheese.
Oh, yeah. But it melts, too.
That's why I was like suddenly, because it's been a long time, and I was like, wait, I used to.
It oh runs God. Out the back.
There's this great scene that actually happened in real life, which is when your brother, who is 75 and gets into bed in the middle of his party, and this also happens in the book, right?
Yes.
Where he asks you, he says, hermano, mira pues, come into bed.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the whole family is in bed.
Yeah. You know our families. You know, they're like, oye, tío Luis is in bed with dad. ¿Qué? Vamos a ver. And they're looking in and they're like, yo. And we had, you know, first kids getting in bed, and then some of the cholillos showed up. Orale, loco, just get in here with pops and tío Luis, you know, throwing signs. Hey. And then, you know, family coming, and then my wife and my daughter, they got in bed with us. And so it was like this changing cast of people climbing in Juan's bed. And he was a very involved father, but he was also, you know, an old school Mexicano, not demonstrative, not huggy or kissy, never said, I love you. If people would complain, oye, pa, ¿por qué no dices I love you? And he says, didn't I show you?
I think that's exactly what my dad would say.
My dad, too.
Except then my dad got Alzheimer's and then,
oh, man.
I love you, papi, I love you, too.
Ah. This Which was really, that really moment, cute. You know, where Juan, he was so tired and his body was destroyed and he'd have to go lie down. And so he called for me and said, Luis, come in. And I went in there and I had never hugged him before. And he was like, acuéstate. I was like, what? He said, come on. I said, you want me in bed with you? He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And we lay there on and off all day. And one of the really beautiful things about it is that all of us siblings, when the other siblings knew that he and I were in bed, they came in, and we have one picture that's the last picture ever taken of all of us together. And he's in the middle looking very happy, and there we were all piled on the bed with him. And it was just this amazing thing that I thought, why can't I find some way for everybody in Iowa and Nebraska
to know this about us?
To see this. What is stopping them from seeing? And one of the things that you have to do, especially with the kids, they sometimes want to cry about it, but they want to laugh about it. If you can make it seem survivable, right? And I tell our kids, this thing that's happening right now is just a current obsession because this country hates and distrusts immigrants, always has. I tell them, do your historical research, find out what Ben Franklin said about Germans, which sounds like what people are saying about you, and know that one day the numbers are with you. It's going to pass, and they're going to find somebody else to be mad at. So I always tell them, one of these days, the next president is going to be like, we got to stop those damn Norwegians from coming out. And the kids burst out laughing. I say, believe me, there's going to be a wall on the East Coast stopping Vikings. You know?
up on Latino USA, Luis Alberto Urrea on how Trump-era attacks on immigrants seeped into his book.
Because you just live your life. You don't go around thinking, well, I'm an oppressed Mexican.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 20 years of grant-making and supporting a new initiative to help retain physician scientists with caregiving obligations. Learn more at ddcf.org. And Fifth Generation Inc., maker of 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. Distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we're speaking with writer Luis Alberto Urrea about his new book, The House of Broken Angels. Your characters are Republicans, they're IT workers, they're Army vets who don't have citizenship. You have, you know, a character who is obsessed with being on time. Who's Mexican, obsessed with being on time. By the way, I have many of them in my family.
Me too. That was my dad. Part of his point was, if you come from Mexico, you come to the United States with a green card in 1958 and try to make a life in San Diego, you're going to find out really quickly how unwelcoming it is for a Mexicano. And his point was to be more intelligent, more prepared, and more informed than the Americanos who looked down on him. He memorized the dictionary 5 pages a week so he could speak English better. And he always said, you must be on time. In fact, always be early, always be neat and clean, always be clean shaven, have an iron shirt and iron pants. He never wore blue jeans a day in his life.
Mi papa.
¿Verdad?
Mi papa never wore blue jeans
right?
in his life.
My dad too. We went to Sinaloa and we would go to these long trips and he would take me all over Mexico. And we got there and I came out barefoot, and he said, they're going to think you're a libertine. I said, what? I was just barefoot.
On one of these trips when your dad and you are going from San Diego through Mexico, your dad gives you The Godfather by Mario Puzo, which I did not read at the time, although it was on my father's nightstand. What up with the book The Godfather and why your dad gave it to you and what it means in terms of The House of Broken Angels, your love song to that book?
Well, my mom and dad were both big readers. So like many kids, I knew where the naughty books were hidden in the bookshelf because I was always looking for those. And my dad had two books, 100 Years of Solitude, which he said, Luis, este libro es la historia de Rosario Sinaloa. It's all about our hometown in Sinaloa. And the other one was The Godfather.
You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
Luis, este libro te enseña que es ser americano, right? You're going to be an American. If you read this book, you'll understand our plight. And I thought, gangsters? But no, what he was talking about was bringing your culture with you and protecting it and being American, doing what you had to do to survive in America. But he really liked those Sicilians and the way they kept their stuff going and looked out for things. And it blew my mind. And it came rushing back when we were sitting at the party and my brother is in his wheelchair, all tiny now and frail. And all the generations of Mexicanos coming to thank him. And I think it was more even than he had imagined, that they would kiss his hand or take a knee before him or touch him gently. And I said to him, just kind of like the wedding scene in The Godfather. And he just nodded. And I said, carnal, you're like Don Corleone. And he said, es que soy Don Corleone. You know, I am Don Corleone.
So one of the things that's happened, I don't know, Luis, I didn't think I was going to ask you this question, but about Trump, you know.
Dead silence.
Well, you yourself said the truth is that the Trump, whatever you want to call it, has actually helped in terms of the attention for your book, for your writing, for your characters.
It's interesting to me that the people who have a heart for us, for our people, are loving us more and more and more. This will probably mean something to you, but Rudolfo Anaya, you know, the great Mexican-American author from New Mexico, wrote Bless Mi Ultima. I've told this to a lot of audiences lately, but when I was a kid, he told me, Luis, if you can take your abuelita from Tijuana and make her the grandmother of a reader in Nebraska or Iowa or someplace in the Midwest, you've made the most political and religious gesture anyone could make. And I started thinking, okay, so where's our big Mario Puzo novel? Where's our big outsider quote in America? I don't want to say immigrants because I don't consider us immigrants. But where is that family epic? And so that book started to happen around the events I saw. The weird tone, the unleashing of the no secret to you and me, what burbles away in the background and underneath of people resenting us and being cruel to us.
You were bullied.
As soon as we got to a little white working class suburb, yeah, yeah. People started calling me these names and I thought, what the heck, you know, greaser, wetback, taco bender. I grew up with that.
I know when you said that, I was like, because let's see, put it into context. It's the 1960s,
yes,
the late 1960s in San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
And you're in a working class community that's mostly white.
Oh, yeah. We went from Tijuana to Logan Heights. And I came out of Tijuana talking Tijuana. I spoke Spanish first, so I talk like my brothers still. Some of them talk, right? And
of course, your appearance is...
Yeah, Irish.
Irish, right?
So nobody knew what to make of it.
So they were just like...
What's up with this guy?
But because of the fact that you clearly were Mexican-identified, spoke like a Mexican, it didn't really matter about the color of your skin.
And I was just telling some kids this story, but my cousins would come from Sinaloa. Jaime, who was my hero, who didn't know English, and we were walking down the street and some idiot pulled up in a truck and yells, hey, taco bender, go back where you came from. And my cousin says, what did you want, cheeseburger? Which to me was like instant English and a comeback that made me just insane with joy. But that energy is uncorked big time right now. And it's getting more and more acceptable, I think, to say those things and to, you know, you see the actions out there and they're directed at our kids. So I thought, I'm going to have Trumpian attacks like we go through out of the blue. And it'll be a startling moment for, you know, you're going to grandma's funeral and someone holds up a sign, build a wall at you. And then later on, you're in Target buying a birthday cake. And somebody walks up to you in the middle of a perfectly fine morning and says, you're going to get put out of the country soon. So I thought if those little things could startle a reader like they startle us, because you just live your life. You don't go around thinking, well, I'm an oppressed Mexican.
Right? I'm waiting to be insulted now.
Yes, yes. No, you're living your life and you're doing your best and you're constantly told you're here to steal jobs. It's like, what stinking job will you do then that I'm doing for you? Not one. Or you're here to steal Social Security. It's like, I'm paying into Social Security. I'll never get that Social Security.
I always found it interesting when they were saying, you will not replace us. And it's like, oh, we don't want to replace you. We want to hang out with you. We want to party with you. We want to work with you. We want to sometimes fall in love with you. Sometimes we'll fight you.
Yeah.
But we don't want to replace you.
We're just people.
Luis Alberto Urrea, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
Luis Alberto Urrea is a writer, poet, and essayist. His new book is called The House of Broken Angels. And to end our show this week, a segment from our How I Made It series. This week, we hear from Uruguayan singer and composer Jorge Drexler. That's Jorge tuning his guitar while he was on tour with his most recent album, Salvavidas de Hierro. We met Jorge at his hotel in Manhattan, where he took out the guitar to play us a piece of one of the songs from that album. It's called Movimiento. And the song is a statement about the current immigration debate. And through it, Jorge explores what's at the essence of human movement. Here's Jorge Drexler.
I had this habit to write in this record. I would take my children to school in the morning and then come back in the car and turn the radio on and just use it as a generator of random ideas. One day I opened the radio and there was this program that said Movimientos Migratorios, of the migratory movements, and I turned it off and I said, of course, migrations are a kinetic act. I mean, you have to move. And I thought, why don't we look at migrations from a wider angle? Like as though as we fast forwarded the last 30,000 years of our species, when we left Africa, and very quickly, we covered the whole planet as sapiens, as humans. Somos una especie en viaje. No tenemos pertenencias, sino equipaje. There's two things that we all did. We played music, there isn't a culture without music, and we moved, all of us. We are alive as a species because we moved. We searched everywhere. We always tried to get a better life for our children than the one that we had. So it's not something new. And in my particular case, I say in the song, somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos inmigrantes. We are fathers, sons, grandsons, and great-grandsons from immigrants. Somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos de inmigrantes. Es más mío lo que sueño. In my particular case, my father was born in Berlin. They were German Jews, and they had to flee Nazism. And the only country in 1939 that received them was Bolivia, actually. So I'm very grateful to Bolivia. And then they came into Uruguay, and he met my mother, which is from Spanish origin and Portuguese and French origins. And that's how I'm here, New York, speaking to you today. I really can't understand how we still keep coming back.
Apenas nos pusimos en dos pies.
To this lack of empathy, that it's people every once in a while get scared of the other and you know, and go back to making a clear difference between this is me and this is you, and I'm from here and you are not from here. And you know, it's wrong.
Nunca estamos quietos, somos transhumantes, somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos de inmigrantes. Es más mío lo que sueño.
I like to speak in a wide angle view to say that I'm, yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco. I'm not from here, but neither are you.
Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco. Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco.
Of course, I'm not that naive to not realize that there's borders and they're active. But my job is to give this side perspective to this issue and just hope that people will listen to it and have it in the back of their heads and remember things are not that black and white as they may seem regarding your origin. Que lo que toco, yo no soy de aquí. Pero tú tampoco, yo no soy de aquí. Pero tú tampoco, de ningún lado del todo. De todos lados un poco.
That was Uruguayan singer and composer Jorge Drexler, who joined us from his hotel room in New York City. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. Production help this week from Ashley Cleek. Our senior editor is Marlon Bishop. Fact-checking by Zoe Malik. Our engineers are Jeannie Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Maya Cueva and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music that you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, and this week I want to say a special goodbye to my executive assistant, Zoe Malik. Zoe joined us actually as a scientist who wanted to learn how to do media. And, well, she's done a great job. Zoe, congratulations on your next big move. We'll be watching you on Samantha Bee. And thank you for everything you've done for me, Zoe. I really appreciate it. Gracias. See you again on the next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Winecoat Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. And the Epstein Family Foundation, in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tumana Memorial Fund, established to support NPR's international journalists, their coverage, and their commitment to providing the news of the world to audiences back home. This is NPR.